This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Covering the Middle East as a foreign correspondent for CBS News, Kimberly Dozier, a graduate of Mr. Jefferson's University, earned a reputation for being on top of the story. But on Memorial Day 2006, Kimberly Dozier became the story as a car bomb took the lives of her crew, a U.S. Army captain, and an Iraqi interpreter, and left her in a pool of blood on the street, fighting for her life. Her new book is Breathing the Fire, and it reconstructs her path from the bombing to recovery, from the instant that she was, after she was critically injured on the battlefield, to the fight to keep her alive. I am honored to welcome to the program my friend, Kimberly Dozier. How are you, Kimberly?
Great to talk to you, Coy.
Absolutely. Now, you are exactly where? You're in Washington, right?
I'm sitting in the Washington, D.C. CBS Bureau. Just got back from our offices in the Pentagon and just listened to Secretary of Defense Gates give us the lay of the land, which meant avoiding most of our really tough questions.
Oh. So you have, I guess, well, we want to hear the story, of course, but I guess the best, let's just start with the fact that you have been incredibly busy with this book. I mean, now that it's done, gosh, what news channel have we not seen you? In fact, I think you even just did Geraldo this afternoon, right?
That's where I'm headed next, actually, as you were saying, that you're about to do Roger Ailes' book after this. I thought, well, that's ironic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been trying to get the word out. The first chapter of the book is the story that you know about the bomb blast, how the guys at the scene fought to save our lives, keep us alive. Captain Alex Funkhauser and his translator, Sam, and Paul and James, Paul Douglas and James Brolin, my camera crew, were all killed just about instantly. But there were another four of us who were gravely injured, and the troops there, plus an Iowa National Guard team that ran in, all fought to keep us alive. The rest of the book is telling you about this world that I didn't know about until I had to live through it. What the combat injured go through to get back to health.
And it's a gripping story, and we want to let folks know, I guess they should know in advance, that the photographs in the book, you don't hold anything back, both in the text and in the photographs themselves. I don't really have a word for them. They're incredibly moving, and it's horrific to see what you went through.
Horrific is a good word, yeah. My nurse in Landstuhl took pictures maybe 3 days after the blast, and you can see where the shrapnel went into my skull, and there's a big semicircular scar because they had to remove part of the skull to get the shrapnel out. Also, because I lost more than half my blood, they had to give me something like 40 units of blood. That's
wow.
More than an adult's worth. So the body's reaction is like to an allergy. You swell up. I looked a bit like a cross between Darth Vader and Jabba the Hutt. And I put that in there so you could see, okay, this is what they had to work with. My legs were shattered, burned from hips to ankles. You can see the CT scan of the bones with the titanium rods through them that they had to hammer through to put the femurs back together. And from that state, within a month, I was standing. Within 2 months, I was walking with a cane.
Amazing.
And within 9, I was running again. And that's what they do with something like 30,000 of us who've been injured in Iraq or Afghanistan. There's this army of people who they start at the casualty hospitals in Baghdad and Balad, then Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, and then back here at places like Bethesda Naval, where I stayed, Walter Reed, the Brooke Army Medical Center down in Texas. They have gotten to a new state of the art in terms of taking someone who's been literally blasted apart and getting you back to some semblance of normal. But what I also got to see was the corpsmen, you know, they're supposed to work these four-day shifts, which are 12 to 13 hours. They never stay just 12 hours. It's always more. And then they would come in on their days off. just to visit us, just to say hi. They couldn't tear themselves away. It was that kind of commitment. My physiotherapist, whose job it was to get my knees to bend again, she would come in on the 4th of July, 7 days a week, and spend an hour and a half just trying to get my legs to work again. And at first, when I couldn't lift my legs, it meant it was all her lifting up the legs and then just cranking on the knees, me screaming through gritted teeth.
Oh, gosh.
But she was like, if you can take it, I'm going to keep coming in here and working with you. Her rule was, as long as the patient was giving more than 100%, she would.
CBS News foreign correspondent Kimberly Dozier is my guest. The new book is Breathing the Fire, much anticipated story that she has written herself about what happened from that moment from the car bomb in 2006 until her full recovery. And like you point out, it's really not just your story. This is the story, really the behind the scenes look at what is happening to all those men and women who suffer like this in war. And this miracle of medicine that now exists that can literally bring them back from the brink.
Absolutely. Well, there are also some problems that we're encountering. I go through all these complications I encountered in the hospital bed. You know, so many of us are surviving the bomb scene that we're going on to develop these other symptoms, side effects. Like, I had these spikes growing out of my blast-injured bones. I mean, the bones don't just heal when you get a blast. Sometimes they go crazy and form these coral-like spikes that stick into your muscles. And this is called heterotopic ossification. Nobody knows why it grows. They don't know how to turn it off. The only way to get rid of it is to wait 6 to 9 months after the original injury and then chisel it out. That means another round of full surgery. We need something like millions of dollars of research to try to figure this out now that we have so many people developing it. Before this conflict, the only people to develop this sort of thing were a few hip replacement patients and motorcycle accident victims. So the bad news is we don't know quite what to do about it. The good news is this will help drive trauma research that helps folks back here stay alive.
Right.
The tourniquets that they used on me in that Baghdad street are a step beyond what we use here or had used here 3 or 4 years ago. Now they're being carried by EMTs in ambulances at major trauma centers across this country, and they're helping keep regular civilians alive.
We're talking with Kimberly Dozier of CBS News. Her new book, which I strongly encourage everyone to buy, it's an amazing story, is Breathing the Fire, and you can learn more online at KimberlyDozier.com. Kimberly, take us to the moment of the of when the bomb went off. What do you remember?
Well, we were walking down the street outside of our Humvees towards a group of Iraqis. When the bomb hit, Paul and James, my camera crew, and Captain Funkhauser and his translator were all ahead of me, as it turns out, closer to this 500-pound car bomb. The insurgents were apparently watching from a post in an apartment building above. They waited till we were all within about 20 feet, and they triggered the bomb. What I knew was that there had been some sort of explosion. I got slammed into black. I could smell something like 1,000 matches, this sulfur smell. But I couldn't move. So when I came to, the first thing was to try to figure out, where am I? What happened? Where are Paul and James? And I kept asking everyone who eventually came up to help me, and no one would tell me. They knew what had happened to Paul and James, but you don't tell a patient who's struggling to survive on the ground that she's lost her team, because they want to keep you calm. They want to keep you fighting for life. And we were on the ground for an hour waiting for rescue. I remember about 10 minutes of that, talking to the staff sergeant who was working on me. From then on, it was a team of people at the Baghdad Casualty Hospital who had to fight for about four of us to keep us alive. I coded about five times, one of the doctors told me. That means they had to resuscitate me five times once I got to the Baghdad Casualty Hospital. They didn't even notice at first that I had shrapnel in my brain because both of my legs were smashed, and they had to stabilize those to stop the bleeding because your femurs are, pretty close to some pretty sensitive real estate. A lot of blood vessels travel through those bones, and my femoral artery had been nicked by shrapnel as well. So, it was about as touch and go as it gets.
What an amazing story. And, gosh, I mean, the determination and the grit and the courage really throughout that whole thing that you're – I mean, every PT session that you went into – it must have taken tremendous courage just to go through those.
You know, it's one of these things where you wouldn't choose to be in that situation. But once you're there, it's more you have this choice. You can either sit there and feel sorry for yourself and wallow in the pain, or you can fight it. And I had a lot of people around me to help me fight it. I had my parents there, my boyfriend Pete, all of the nurses and the doctors, and especially those corpsmen I mentioned, essentially nursing assistants, who are with you round the clock. And, you know, if you give it your all, they're going to be there for you as well. So it becomes it feeds on itself. Them cheering me, pushing me, pulling me along, and me also wanting to fight to get better. The other thing was, when I would occasionally be able to get out of my hospital room and get wheeled down the hall past some of the other patients, the soldiers and the airmen and the Marines who were all in the same state, I remember this one kid, you know, he must have been 19, double amputee, and he went racing past me on his brand new state-of-the-art wheelchair that he had already learned how to do wheelies in. And he'd had it for something like 12 hours. You look at that and you go, and I'm feeling sorry for myself. Why?
Kimberly Dozier, CBS News foreign correspondent. The book is Breathing the Fire, and it's available now in bookstores. Kimberly, let's talk about the writing of the book, because, you know, for years, the writing that you have done has been,
pretty straight.
It's very straightforward, news. Unemotional news. This is what happened. This is what I saw happen. I talked to this person. This is what they said. This is what we're learning. This is a different animal. What was this experience like for you?
Painful, terrifying. Just sitting down in front of a computer and saying, all right, I'm going to write about the most painful incident in my life and everything that came afterwards. I like to say I got tricked into doing it. There was a counselor at Bethesda Naval Hospital, a naval psychotherapist who was there on his National Guard duty. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had someone like that available to talk to. They're still working on hiring enough staff to talk to the injured. And he said, you know, you've been talking about the incident since you opened your eyes, and that's great. Because I had some of the neuropsychiatrists trying to tell me not to talk about the incident. So there was a bit of tension between the two.
Really?
Of them.
That's interesting.
But, yeah, because there's a theory that, well, I had a brain injury, so I should wait till it healed and then go down that difficult road. No, me, I wanted to go down that road right away. So and the psychologist is like, OK, you want to talk about it? Keep talking. And he said, and you know what? You're such a great writer. He had no idea what my writing was like. He's like, you should really write about it down the road. And so I sat down after I'd left the hospital with a computer and started to put the incident together, everything I could remember. And I started trying to track down everyone who'd been at the scene, especially because I'd found during my last couple weeks in the hospital, I put out this thank you note to the world saying thank you to the guys at the scene for helping save me. And the grandmother of one of the troops who'd been on guard at the scene, she'd given me this newspaper account that had identified Medic Izzy Flores as the person who'd saved my life and been working on me directly. So poor Izzy, I put him in this difficult position. I thanked him. And once I realized that I'd thanked the wrong medic, I thought, I've got to find out exactly what happened from everyone who was there. I'm not going to make any more mistakes like this.
Yeah.
And so for the next 2 or 3 months, I would write a chapter about what I could remember, and then I'd look people up, find some other things out, and rewrite. It was excruciating. Sometimes I'd write 2 or 3 paragraphs and just have to retreat from the computer, curl up in a ball in tears, and that's all I could do for the day. But it helped. And for me, you know, the flashbacks and the nightmares stopped before I even left the hospital. And the counselors believe that's because, for me, I talked so much. Talk therapy works for me. And then afterwards, it was essentially called, it's grief processing. It's figuring out what happened in the trauma and then putting it past you. So that now I can sit here and talk to you about how I felt thinking about having lost Paul and James, how their families must have felt, how you deal with being the survivor. And I can do that now without pain. A year ago, I couldn't have.
Kimberly Dozier, CBS News foreign correspondent. Her new book is Breathing the Fire, Fighting to Report and Survive the War in Iraq. She's online at KimberlyDozier.com. We've got a couple of minutes left, but I did want to ask you, when you're talking about talking, it sounds to me like there's something that the medical community could really learn from your experience, from watching you, that if they could get more of these men and women who go through these traumas to talk more and have that kind of therapy, it could help. Because there's a lot of them, let's admit, that don't talk and have problems for a long time.
Well, actually, some of the members of the military medical community have really reached out to me, asked me to address bodies of doctors. I've been invited to speak to a senior group of generals and naval commanders next month at the Pentagon about this issue. But one of the things I have to stress is that talk therapy works for some people. Drug therapy works for others. The most important thing that military commanders want to get across to their troops, you know, at least what I would call some of the more enlightened ones, is if you talk about something that freaked you out from the beginning, or if you even just acknowledge that it's freaking you out, whether it's in a blog or in a conversation with your wife or husband back home, just that bit of opening up that something's bugging you can head off a lot of what later can become post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a message that more and more commanders are trying to get across to the troops. So if me being a loudmouth media person talking about it also helps, fantastic.
Just to validate that experience somehow, that yes, I recognize that it happened and it freaked me out.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, the same method, what worked for me is not going to work for everyone out there. 85% of people who go through trauma process it in a way that does not produce vivid dreams, vivid memories. Some of those people, it doesn't help them to talk about the incident. But you got another 15% who process things in a very vivid fashion and it comes back to haunt them. They're the people who, if something's haunting you, that's a signal from your body, your mind, and your soul. You got to find a way to get it out.
Kimberly Dozier, the book is Breathing the Fire. She is a award-winning foreign correspondent for CBS News, and we've been honored to have her on the program. And this country has been fortunate to have her literally on the front lines, keeping us informed and in touch about what's going on in the world. Kimberly, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.